I'm Larry Rasmussen, and this is the second in the series on the moral state of the Union in the United States today. I said I'd give a commercial only once, but I said that yesterday. This is my only once today. I'm pushing the book that I just completed and is in the bookstore, and we're taking a topic from that today, and we'll see where it goes. The book pays special attention to how those communities are doing which deeply shape the kinds of person we are. Communities of moral formation, communities of human character and conduct formation. So families, neighborhoods, schools, houses of worship, voluntary agencies. And I try to ask in this inquiry about what it is in our society that aids these communities into shaping people into the kinds of persons they are, and what it is in our society that undermines the work of what we might simply call the formation of moral community itself. But of course, the kinds of persons we are, from a moral point of view, isn't only the outcome of these particular communities. A whole society shapes its members, just as the members themselves shape the society that in turn shapes them. So a crucial question for moral analysis is, what are the models of society that we're living by, whether consciously or unconsciously? Culture is always, for us, kind of second nature. After a while, we think that's the way things are. I'm going to ask the question today about what are the models of society that we're presently living by, and how do they impact the moral life? How are they shaping our sense of who we are? The two most prominent ones in this century are society on the model of the market and society on the model of the state. And those are the two we're going to look at today. My thesis is that for very understandable reasons, the market, or you can say the economy, and state have taken on major moral tasks in this century, which have in turn had a negative effect on the nurturing and the exercising of moral responsibility and care. Now, this will get a little bit complex because it has absolutely necessary that the market and the state take on moral tasks. And yet at the same time, some of the spillover from that has been to impair the moral life. Okay, that's the thesis. Now let's see what we can do to explain that in some detail. And then, no matter where we are at 3 minutes past the hour, we'll turn it into discussion. The first question that I want to address is, why have we turned to the market and the state as models of and for society itself, and as a means to meeting essential moral responsibilities? And the short answer for that is that the modern world is, by definition, a world of millions, now billions, of interdependent strangers, whom we will never know and whom we will never see. It's very difficult being on good terms with 5 billion, 1 billion, 5 billion people. It's hard to be good, close friends with even 1 million. And yet all of these, all of us share a common space and common resources on a pretty small planet. And these millions of interdependent strangers thus shape our lives just as we shape theirs. Okay. That means that other communities or other agents than local communities, families, networks of voluntary organizations will have to do some of what society itself must do. Now, what society must do is regulate behavior and address our obligations to one another as kind of gathered foreigners who occupy a public space together and who share resources under constrained conditions. There have to be ways of organizing life together en masse, and networks that have moral responsibility as their task, families, churches, schools, can't do all that. So we have to have massive systems of the economy and the state, in this instance, to coordinate that which is necessary to meet human needs across wide expanses and among people who don't know one another and who don't feel a strong sense of obligation to one another. We must have frameworks and mechanisms, the state and the market, that these other communities do not provide. The modern market, for example, is an institution able to outstrip any network of communities in creating a dynamic and spontaneous order from millions of independent, decentralized decisions. Nobody else can do that. No other mechanism. Neither a network of communities or the state can, by conscious design, begin to match the market's ability to allocate resources. It utterly charms its worshippers and its critics alike by achieving a degree of order and efficiency independent of human goodness, government coercion, or even extensive knowledge. Now, this necessary coordination of millions of interdependent decisions through the economy. Is not the only reason that the market draws. A society with the vigor of capitalist markets released millions of people from the grip of various command economies and command societies, from feudalism and aristocracy to communism. And in the process, extended a lot of freedom and fostered a lot of creativity. This is as much a moral achievement as it is a strictly economic and political one. Now, granted, capitalist markets are anti-community. But the communities that they often break up, to recall Karl Marx, who incidentally praised capitalism for breaking up homogeneous and constrictive communities, the communities they often break up are frequently restrictive, suffocating communities devoid of possibilities for entering new worlds and freedom. So, market society has often meant an enormous advance in not just generating wealth, but generating freedom. But wealth as well. And since what is not produced cannot be distributed, this too is an achievement. In a world that's technically capable of producing enough, hunger and unmet material needs are moral crimes. And the market has been an engine that has produced unprecedented wealth. In fact, capitalism was the first economic system to lift the masses out of their misery, economic misery. I'm just saying that's a moral achievement. And there's a reason why we have turned to the market as a kind of model for society. But, as you all know, there are deep and persistent injustices in capitalist market economies. And it was the failure of the inordinate power of capitalism to address certain things. Unemployment, actually, to create them, in part. Unemployment, poverty, homelessness, extremes of wealth and poverty, disruption of closed communities, that all happens with a free-flowing capitalist economy. It was the failure of capitalism to address those that the state was deemed a necessary moral counterforce. Now, capitalism opposed as slavery, for example, as an element of feudal and aristocratic caste system, and it welcomed the free movement of labor, but then it exploited that labor and produced a lot of wage slaves instead. Furthermore, it didn't care at all for people who were unable, for one reason or another, to enter a dynamic job market or were too disadvantaged to push into the ranks of the entrepreneurs. Indeed, everything that fell outside of capitalist markets was labeled an externality and left out of the economy's consideration, whether that was people or ecosystems. So, this persistent injustice and neglect in capitalist societies is what led many to call upon the state then as the other model, and develop it as the other model of society. The state answered the call and either commanded, so it thought, the high moral ground with a command economy, or it complemented a system of capitalist markets with regulations in order to do those things which markets, when they're left alone, do not do or fail to do well. Things like regulate public goods, roads, national defense, education, parks, and so on. Address these externalities. The market won't take care of greenhouse gases or acid rain or black lung disease, I assure you. Or the state might need to maintain the conditions of competition itself. Economic power tends to be concentrated as a result of markets, so that winners grow and losers disappear. It's necessary then to reestablish the very conditions of competition, and the markets won't do that. Or the state needs to consider the social injustices of racism, sexism, homophobia, and so on, which are either simply neglected by markets or exacerbated, so that racism and poverty play upon one another in a capitalist society. Thus, while there are considerable differences among the welfare capitalist societies of Europe, the established socialist societies on several continents, and the social policy sector of this society, all of them end up sharing the conviction that the state is a moral agent, is a kind of moral proxy, if you will, for meeting obligations en masse through law and bureaucracy. And has to do so because other communities cannot do that. So, to conclude this, reasons for turning to the state and society as models for society, state and market. There's just a lot of imperatives here and a lot of history that have that have made Market and State compelling them for the moral life in a world of millions of interdependent strangers. My question, though, is not one of kind of moral legitimacy of the market or moral legitimacy of the state or whether they're going to be around. They're both going to be around for a while. My question is, what is the outcome for the moral life of people by turning these two agencies into models for society itself? Do you hear the difference? Capitalism is not any longer in this society simply a way of organizing economic life. It's a culture.
Right.
It is a model of society and not just the economy. In established socialist states, the state was not just a way of organizing political governance. It was a model for the whole society. And what has happened now to the moral life of people when these ways of meeting some needs become models for organizing most of life, either separately or together? The first thing I need to say then is what has happened in this society to make the move from Adam Smith, who never thought about capitalism as a model for society. In fact, he couldn't have conceived of a capitalist society. He could only have thought about a capitalist market. We are no longer anywhere near Adam Smith and early capitalism, because of capitalism becoming the new economy was the first bourgeois revolution. We live after the second bourgeois revolution, and that's capitalism as a model for society and as a culture. And the key for the second bourgeois revolution is that the moral order and culture are organized on the same principle as the economy and share its ethos. Adam Smith and early capitalism said that for the economy to work at all as a capitalist economy, there has to be a whole sector of non-economic life which nurtures ties of trust and solidarity, and provides the very morality upon which people can live with a capitalist economy. So you have to have a kind of civil society, independent or separate from the economy, that is the moral base for the whole society. So you ought not to run families like you run the rough and tumble of the marketplace. You have a different sector there. The second bourgeois revolution, however, more recent, came to full flower in the 1980s, but has episodes before that, says that all of society and its decisions can be fashioned and executed in the manner that economic actors do, namely, with the calculation of self and group interest. That you can apply that to all decisions in society. You work out a good prenuptial agreement before you enter into this contract of marriage, to cite one example. So self-interest is the one language Gary Becker and the Chicago School of Economics and other people responsible for the second bourgeois revolution said, self-interest is the one language everybody understands. And you ought to apply it to all actions and all decisions and all domains. It thereby provides you with a predictable, objective order in which everybody can participate on exactly the terms they know best. Gary Becker was, just got a Nobel Economics Prize, although not for this, I hope. But he represents the second bourgeois revolution with about as little guile as any, and argues directly against Adam Smith himself. He's fully aware that he's arguing against Adam Smith's refusal to extend the logic of self-interest into non-economic territory. Smith said that'll be a disaster. I actually couldn't quite conceive of it. But he was so insistent that moral sentiments cultivated in non-economic sectors were essential to society. But Becker says, moral principles apply to all human behavior, be it behavior, I'm quoting now, be it behavior involving money prices or imputed chattel prices, repeated or infrequent decisions, large or minor decisions, emotional or mechanical ends, rich or poor persons, men or women, adults or children, brilliant or stupid persons, patients or therapists, businessmen or politicians, teachers or students. End of quotation. In this scheme, individuals are all what he calls, an economist called, utility maximizers. And there we have the framework for our moral decisions. Now, quite apart from the markets, then, there is a mental process of market logic that supplies all the guidance that you need for moral and other considerations necessary to make the thousands of decisions that we have to make. So that's, we live now in the second bourgeois revolution, where that, it isn't completely taken over, but where that has become largely a picture of how society as a whole should operate. When you vote, you think in those terms. When you make decisions about something in the neighborhood, I can give you an example later of a church, attempt to build a church in Rancho San Diego, and the community hearings that were held about whether or not that church should be built there. When you take into consideration about whether a church should be located in your community, you ought to proceed on this basis of a self and group interest, and just weigh up assets and costs. All right. Now, let's go to the question of what the outcome is for the moral life of that plus the state as the model, which I'll get to in a second. My argument is going to be that capitalist societies draw on a morality that they fail to reproduce on that basis. If you work on the basis of self and group interests, you do not reproduce the morality that you actually have, even to make capitalism work. Capitalism assumes trust. People keeping their word. People learning to return books to the library. People learning moral obligation in ways that isn't simply a reflection of their own calculations, of their own interests. There are a whole lot of things that are required for the society in which capitalism will properly function that cannot be learned by capitalist logic. And my argument is simply that it draws upon a morality it doesn't reproduce. That's part of our discussion. Ironically, this neglect of kind of the moral source, the moral base, has meant the development, quite against the official ideology of capitalism, of an elaborately bureaucratized and expensive society. And you shouldn't get that in a capitalist order, an elaborately bureaucratized and expensive society. But we have. Why? Because society cannot handle, in more informal ways, the array of problems that any society faces when its human bonds are atomized. We handle all sorts of things on the basis of relationships of trust and solidarity, which when those are frayed, you end up having to handle it by law, by bureaucracy, and you end up with a whole lot of problems that you got to pay for, that you didn't have to pay for. For the supposedly freest society then becomes the most litigious one. A region known for its no-holds-barred deregulated individualism, example, the Los Angeles Basin of Southern California, turns out to be a region strapped with innumerable regulations. Fully against its own intentions, professionalized in-group bureaucracy becomes the political form of the second bourgeois revolution, and its morality eroding market mentality. Capitalism, the capitalist society in this form becomes bureaucracy and has to turn more and more to law because the market fails to provide society with a moral guidance system of its own so that many, many problems are handled in the course of learning how to handle them in relationship to one another. Now the sheer cost of this, just the cost of this, is staggering. I mean, if it's mildly true that crime doesn't pay, it's true with a vengeance that society suffering the breakdowns that stem from moral collapse face a very long list of very expensive social problems. Adequate protection and security, the price of enacting and enforcing laws and regulations aimed to check abuse and corruption in business and government, social welfare check for domestic violence and unwanted children or unwanted spouses, cleanup costs for willfully violating the environment, loss of public revenues through cheating on taxes. That's just the beginning of a list of problems which occur when the moral base is corroded. And when you make market the model for the whole society, those are the kinds of things which are not produced in the moral base for that society. Now, what did I say? 3 minutes past the hour? All right, it's going to have to be quick. Let's turn to the state then. I may have to set my watch back. let's turn to the state as a model.
Larry, that's what you call Rasmus and savings
time. Savings, yes, savings time. This is my kind of savings time. Let's just be provocative. I think from a moral point of view, the Cold War was a massively misplaced debate. I mean, there are lots of good reasons why it happened and why it turned out the way it did. But from a moral point of view, the moral outcome is very similar with capitalism as with socialism. And I'm going to come to that. But let's first take the state now as the model for society, which was epitomized most thoroughly with the established socialist states. The socialist nations tried to provide comprehensive moral formation, tried to do the whole works. They dictated the substance of education, including moral education. They supplied rites and rituals for human passage. There are socialist rites for birth, puberty, marriage, retirement, death, together with a string of socialist holy days, and heroes and heroines, special observances. They designated the forms and recipients. They told farmers how to farm, and teachers how to teach, and doctors how to doctor, and writers how to write. It was, I think, the most comprehensive effort ever made to institutionalize moral obligation under governmental auspices. For reasons that I will be studying for some time, it failed on a scale commensurate with its own attempts and its own bulk. Most ironic of all, this kind of socialism did few things as badly as socialization itself. Now, in the course of studying the failure, including the moral failure of establishment socialism, command socialism, we will be hearing the conservatives' critique again and again. The Bible for that is Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom. It says it rather well, and it means to extend its main point beyond establishment socialism and hold in disdain, as Hayek does, any state with extensive government control. What Milton Friedman, his disciple, calls a nanny state. a state that takes you and leads you by the hand. So you get a nanny. You get a nanny arm from it. One arm is actually longer than the other. quoting from Hayek, "The most important change which extensive government control produces is a psychological change, an alteration in the character of the people." His argument against socialism is a moral argument and not just an economic one. It produces alteration in the character of people. The will of people under socialism, or extensive government control, is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. People are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people, till each nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrial animals, of which government is the shepherd. That's Hayek. But what Hayek and the conservatives overlook, however, is that the market also dulls the sense of moral responsibility and moral agency and produces a psychological change and alteration in the character of the people. Well, how it usually does that is by kind of reifying or making the market a thing in itself, so that we don't see it as a human construct made up of thousands of human decisions for whom humans are accountable. We say human nature and the economy require that this and that be done. And then actions conform. So our sense of moral responsibility for each and every action and accountability on the part of the people making the decisions are actually cast into a strange kind of fate of human nature requires and the market requires. And the outcome of that is that you dullen, you kind of dumb down people's sense of their own capacities, their own responsibilities, and their own accountabilities for the decisions that they make. So you have this kind of irony that socialism and capitalism both end up making people feel actually powerless when they're making all sorts of decisions and making all sorts of choices. Isn't that curious? And it happens under both kinds of orders. So that to make the market the whole of the city rather than one of its zones, and to subject all of life to the morality of the bazaar, B-A-A-R, had much the same impact on people's sense of moral agency and being the creators of morality as did this more statist extreme that the conservatives passionately sought to counter. Now, I'm going to finish now with some quotations from Vaclav Havel. But just before that, as if to pile ironies one on top of another one here, market society with its impersonal efficiency and reliance upon imperious egoism, and state society with its impersonal social policy and reliance upon imperious state responsibility, both fail to reproduce the moral base upon which they depended. Had an interesting conversation with a professor of Marxism-Leninism at the University of Rostock in the former German Democratic Republic. And he was interested in dialogue with the Christians. In fact, he set up a Christian Marxist dialogue within the university because he said the one thing, right, he said, I really believe in socialism as a moral force. And we got to get the economy working. But the one thing we don't do in Marxism is produce or reproduce the morality that we've got to have among the people. They both failed to reproduce the moral base they need, and ironically, they both have failed to deliver what they both promised to achieve in their very different ways, namely the common good. That was the promise of capitalism, was the common good, would be the outcome of all of us acting in our self-interest. Neither of its own accord, neither model mustered the very morality that it depended upon. Civility, loyalty, social solidarity, trust in authority, competence, consideration in human relations. In fact, I think a kind of unarticulated despair now in many quarters is that just when social problems must somehow be addressed en masse, the socialization process requisite for civil existence everywhere is in shambles. From east to west and north to south, from sea to shining sea. While from the point of view of competing Cold War ideologies, democratic capitalism won and command socialism lost, from the point of view of a moral assessment of what happened to the people, the socialist experiment is but a worst case scenario for the capitalist one. Both sides depleted the soils of moral community. Okay. Let me just read to you some comments from now the former president of a small European nation that had both its own proud traditions of an earlier democracy and then had its own forced experiment with command socialism. I refer to President Vaclav Havel. He is talking about the Czech experience. The return of freedom to a place that had become morally unhinged has produced something that it clearly had to produce and therefore something we might have expected. But it has turned out to be far more serious than anyone could have predicted. An enormous and blindingly visible explosion of every imaginable human vice. A wide range of questionable or at least ambivalent human tendencies, quietly encouraged over the years and at the same time quietly pressed to serve the daily operations of the totalitarian system, has suddenly been liberated, as it were, from its straitjacket and given free rein at last. In other words, we didn't have a moral base in socialism, but now freedom has come. So we're liberated from that. The authoritarian regime imposed a certain order, if that's the right expression for it, order, on these vices, and doing so it kind of legitimized them in a sense. This order now has been broken down. But a new order that would limit rather than exploit these vices, an order based on a freely accepted responsibility to and for the whole of society, has not yet been built. Nor could it have been, for such an order takes years to develop and cultivate. And thus we are witnesses to a bizarre state of affairs, Society has freed itself, true, but in some ways it behaves worse than when it was in chains. Criminality has grown rapidly, and the familiar sewage that in times of historical reversal always wells up from the nether regions of the collective psyche has overflowed into the mass media, especially the gutter press. But there are other, more serious and dangerous symptoms. Hatred among nationalities, suspicion, racism, even signs of fascism, vicious demagoguery, intrigue, deliberate lying, politicking, an unrestrained, unheeding struggle for purely particular interests, a hunger for power, unadulterated ambition, fanaticism of every imaginable kind, new and unprecedented varieties of robbery, the rise of different mafias, and general lack of tolerance, understanding, taste, moderation, reason. Well, Havel goes on to discuss what he calls genuine politics and commits himself to a realization of it in Czechoslovakia. That was back when it was Czechoslovakia. The moral grounds, he says, are crucial. I'll finish with this. Genuine politics, politics worthy of the name, and in any case the only politics that I am willing to devote myself to, is simply serving those close to oneself, serving the community, and serving those who come after us. Its deepest roots are moral because it is a responsibility expressed through action to and for the whole. A responsibility that is what it is, a higher responsibility, which grows out of a conscious or subconscious certainty that our death ends nothing. Because everything is forever being recorded and evaluated somewhere else. Somewhere above us, in what I have called the memory of being, an integral aspect of the secret order of the cosmos, of nature and of life, which believers call God, and to whose judgment everything is liable. If you don't have something like that kind of base, then whether you've had the disaster of socialism or now freedom, as all new varieties of vices, then you've got real problems. That's what Havel is saying. So, in my conclusion then is that we're confronted now, I think, with the need to develop another way of thinking about moral formation and about meeting moral obligation in society than relying upon the market as the model for society or the state as a model for society. We will have market and state for the foreseeable future, but they will not do even what they have to do if there is not a moral base produced upon which they draw and which they themselves do not supply. So my question is, society as question. That's the last one up here. If not those, then what? All right. 3 minutes past the hour. I mean, there are lots of things to talk about. You can take issue. You can propose. Fill in the blank here. You can talk about, talk about what you want to talk about.
I think you sort of put down Jerry Decker's idea of self-interest, universally understood language.
Yeah.
Having lived in Tanzania under the wonderful leadership of Julius Nyerere, who took the village model of familyhood, ujamaa, and said what we practiced in the village, we should make a national policy. He said our resources are limited in our country, so in order to make the basic necessities of life available to everybody, we'll start a villagization program where people will have access to good water, electricity, and basic medical care, and so forth. And the whole slogan of build the nation, build a nation. But I feel this wonderful dream of socialism, with which my heart was very much in tune, failed miserably. And I think one of the reasons was that Nyerere himself was such a very fine moral model, mm-hmm. personally, that he didn't understand original sin. Mm-hmm. And he felt that build the nation is a sufficient stimulus to get the people to go ahead and do everything. But people keep asking that question, what's in it for me?
Yeah.
Self-interest was the language that people understood. And in the villages, you'd have the flourishing little garden of the individual, and the communal garden was a failure.
Yeah.
I was equally unsuccessful in my parish, where we inaugurated God's Acre, and I'd go out to the parishes and help them plant them, but it was up to them to continue cultivating, and I'd come back out and say, oh, what a beautiful garden. Is that God? No, 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 that's John's Acre. What's that miserable thing over there? That's God's Acre. That's the way it went in socialism. Everybody's business was nobody's business. And I just think a reasonable addition of the recognition that this is the way we are. And it's not an evil thing to be, have a little self-interest. And even, and I tried to leave Christianity out of this, but I now always fail. But even Jesus, you know, said that the love for the neighbor should be based on the kind of way we love ourselves.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of, well anyway, I think Decker had something that we need to take account of. Nyerere said, national security is destructive of harmony in the world. And if we're going to insist on national security, it will be international insecurity. And he urged that we have a new economic international order. And it was a kind of a restraining thing, as you said, that socialism does. He would put caps on the amount of profit mm-hmm. that organizations and individuals could make.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, well, anyway.
Yeah, good. That's not the problematic here. Yeah.
Had some somewhat similar experiences in China, where, as little we understand it from 10 months there, and split between two occasions, the state system is still oppressively intact,
mm-hmm.
but the market system is coming in with the state's approval, and they're able to feed themselves because they allow the farmers to grow, once they've met their quota, to grow for the market.
Hmm.
And so production has skyrocketed since they've allowed that.
Actually, China's had the highest growth in the economy of any of the countries in the last 10 years.
And they've got some problems of trying to somewhat privatize the inefficient state organizations, but they're doing better certainly than the Soviet system ever did there. But there was a young man that came looking for someone to teach English. As a private venture, he would organize, he would recruit the students, they would pay him, he would pay the teacher, he would get some profit. It didn't work out because he couldn't get permission to use the facility at one of the public schools. The person in charge there was very uncomfortable with the idea of allowing a foreigner in to teach. Not with the private enterprise part of it, but with the foreigner doing the teaching. But he had a number of conversations with us, and he said that he and his friends, they don't believe in Mao anymore. They don't believe in communism. They don't believe in the party with the missionary zeal that there was around 1949 and after that. He says, I wish I had a God, because all I have is trying to better myself economically, and that isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
He had the self-interest, but knew mm-hmm. that wasn't mm-hmm. enough, mm-hmm. but he didn't have the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Mark?
I have an observation and a question for for you or for the group. The observation is, you said that the second bourgeois revolution has reached its full flowering in the 80s. I would suggest that interest group liberalism in the beginning of the 1950s is really where it starts. It's working on the same economic model of the invisible hand. If groups represent their interests as groups, that there will be an invisible hand that will balance competing interests and produce the common good, which clearly doesn't happen, just as the invisible hand doesn't work within the economic market. The question I have is, do you have some thoughts about models of other ways of organizing society? And to push the question a little further, people like Stanley Hauerwas and others are arguing for a communitarian model, and their critics point out that tends to be sectarian. It's all well and good for a small group within society, but how can all of society be organized that way? Could you at least throw out for us some of the alternatives that people are suggesting so that all of us would have more to chew on? Because it's easy to say what's wrong. In some ways, that's more people are reviewed in the New York Times Book Review. Brilliant analyses of what's wrong.
Yeah.
But you could count on one hand, or perhaps if you're missing most of your fingers, the numbers would come up with, it sounds like anything like a feasible way out of the dilemma.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's got a way out of the dilemma that's anything like in full flower. But there is an interesting movement afoot on communitarian lines, along communitarian lines. And it has both secular and religious representatives. The analysis of this society that caught quite a bit of attention in academic circles and beyond, namely Robert Bella and his little tribe of research saints, did the book Habits of the Heart. And that was an analysis of kind of the moral state of affairs in a broad sense of basically white middle class America. Having done that, everybody pressed them to come up with a constructive alternative. And the follow-up to that was the book called The Good Society, which came out last year, which proposes a revival of American institutions on more communitarian a more communitarian ethos. Now, other people like Michael Walzer or Amitai Etzioni in the social sciences and in political theory and social theory are also talking in communitarian terms. If you want an earlier precedent, it's John Dewey's Social Democracy, in which you do not think of democracy along the lines of only individual and self-interest, but you have some sense of a community. A democracy is a community of communities. In the religious communities and in Christian ethics, there is also a focus on a kind of democratic communitarianism. You mentioned Stanley Hauerwas, who is a rather well-known writer in Christian ethics these days, and who pushes the church as a community in society, drawing upon its resources of the faith to flesh out its story and live by it. The attention of all of the communitarian thinkers is on that sector of society which is sometimes called civil society, which means non-economic, non-government actions, those dimensions of our lives, which are basically largely uncoerced, are either not a matter of appealing to profit motives, or responding to what the law says you need to do.
whole range of our lives is lived there, that we often identify with family, church, neighborhood, etc. That sector is often called, sometimes called, civil society. And it's to focus on the revival of civil society by making for more viable communities there that the communitarian movement is pushing. And there's a lot of discussion of that in Christian ethics. I would not call Stanley Hauerwas's version of communitarianism one that is particularly interested in civil society and can be called sectarian. But I think it's absolutely wrong to call the focus on trying to establish stronger local communities of various sorts a sectarian kind of focus, because the idea is that those communities are not to live in and of themselves. They are to be the mechanism by which society is better. That is, there to serve a wider public responsibility. But that there's much talk these days along those lines. Rick,
is it a scale question that really, when you get these systems, either as the economy or the state, to try to organize millions of people in one sort of homogeneous organization, is that attempt that's breaking down, and that we should be focused on smaller groups?
To link your question and Mark's, the small voluntary, largely voluntary, kids don't feel it, the family is a voluntary society, but the small, largely voluntary communities of civil society cannot be the way in which to address all of society's problems, because their scale is not up to that. That's why, Mark, I absolutely reject the notion that says because we have a communitarian model and community can't be the model for the whole society, that therefore that's a sectarian notion. It is not. It's just respecting the scale.
I was living sectarian to Hauerwas.
Yeah, all right. But it focus on community that doesn't make a voluntary community the model for the society doesn't mean that those communities are sectarian. Now, to go the other way, as a matter of scale, to use the economy and the state in some combination. That's what the experiment in modernity is now about. It's a claim that democratic capitalism, combining that polity with that economy, is sufficient on those terms for the good society. Using those instruments of market and state in particular combination. But the reason that doesn't work is because we learn a lot of things in small communities and very early on, which cannot be addressed en masse by huge organizations. I teach social ethics. Sometimes I'm asked, what's the most important age to address issues of social ethics or for the moral development of people? I say, well, 2 to 3 probably. Because the moral life begins not in reason, but in childhood. And the economy and the state can't do all of the things that we have to learn in the process of growing up. I mean, sharing is nice. You know, some pretty basic instruction here that helps shape the kind of people that we are can't be dealt with.